Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. You can listen and subscribe to the show for free on Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. For network or show information, visit BiteRadio.me. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Jim Willis, and we will be talking about his new book, Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys, and Revelations. This fascinating book looks at why so many report uncannily similar experiences, the sensation of floating outside of one's own body, sometimes observing the surroundings or themselves from above, the sense of moving through a tunnel towards something, a vivid, rapid, and comprehensive life review, the appearance of a deceased relative, friends, an overwhelming sense of peace, love, tranquility, and connection, or an encounter with a loving white light, often at the end of the tunnel. Take a thought-provoking journey into an enigmatic phenomena. Near-death experiences is a captivating look at the neurological process, the dream-like explanations, the spiritual, religious, and faith-based interpretations, the psychological views, philosophical possibilities, quantum reality, and the ongoing debates about the nature and meaning of NDEs. Jim Willis earned his master's degree in theology from Andover Newton Theological School, and he has been an ordained minister for more than 40 years. His background in theology and education led to his writing more than 20 books on history, religion, the apocalypse, cross-cultural spirituality, and the mysteries of the unknown. For more information, you can visit Jim's website, which is www.jimwillis.net. And that's JIMWILLIS.net. With that, I'd like to welcome Jim to the show. Good day, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be with you today.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. I don't think I've ever read a book about NDEs from someone with a theological background. So,
well, you know, it's funny. Recently, ever since Raymond Moody and Bruce Grayson, and then and more even more recently, Eben Alexander. We're starting to hear books on NDEs from the medical community. I thought it was only appropriate that someone from the theological community joins in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and from reading your book, I mean, there have been a lot of theologians throughout history who have written about that particular type of experience. So, first, I want to start with, you know, you've written 20 books or more. So can you tell us why you know, what kind of led you to the NDE, the near-death experience topic?
Well, it's a deep, dark secret that most authors, when they write books and people say, why did you want to write about this? To be honest, it's so difficult to get a book published nowadays that when a publisher calls you up and says, I want a book on such and such and here's your advance money, that's kind of hard to turn down. And some of the books that I've written in the past, and the two that I'm working on right now, are, you know, because the publisher wants a particular book on a particular subject. But this one was different. I wrote this one from the heart. And it all goes back, now probably 50 years, back in the 70s. I was in my 20s. I was out of school, just out of school. I was pastor of my first church, and I was a musician, both a jazz musician and a classical musician. and the conductor, and I was a part-time carpenter, and I had my own part-time radio show, and I was just absolutely convinced I knew the answer to everything back when I was in my 20s, as so many of us did. We like to think that we're ready to take on the world, and we have all the answers right at our fingertips. But something happened that I never forgot, and it has been repeated so often over the last 50 years, especially within the last year, that two incidents, one back in the 70s and one just a few years ago, connected in a way that said, I just have to write this book. Back when I was in my 20s, there was a woman in my church whose name, in the book, I call her Hannah. She was just a wonderful, wonderful woman. In her 80s, and she was in the hospital, and I was told by the nurses that she probably wasn't going to be able to come home. And so I got in the habit of visiting her every day and talking, but I knew that she loved the old hymns of the church, so I would take my guitar in with me, and I would sing In the Garden and The Old Rugged Cross and like that. And she used to love it, and she never used to sing much, but she nodded along with me. Sometimes the nurses would push other patients on their beds into the room so that we could have a little choir and sing. And it was, you hate to say it was a lot of fun, given the circumstances, but it was enjoyable to be able to share like that. But on this particular day, which just happens to be the last day I saw her alive, I was putting my guitar away, and she was smiling as she always did, and she said, "Who did you bring with you today?" And I said, "No, Hannah, it's just me." And she gave me a look that seemed to imply that she knew something that I didn't. And she said, "Oh, I know, they're out. They usually wait until you leave to come through the portal. But I think they're attracted by the music." Well, it never occurred to me at the time that music is vibration, and vibration has all kinds of effects which we don't understand. But I was intrigued by her use of the word portal. She didn't say they come through the door. She said portal. Mm-hmm. They're usually waiting outside the portal. And I looked out in the hallway. She couldn't see out in the hallway because there was a curtain between her bed and the hallway. But I could see right out in the hallway. I could see the hallway was empty. And so I didn't want to, you know, confuse an old lady who was near the end of her death or end of her life. So I just smiled and said, "Well, I'll see you next time." It turns out there wasn't a next time. But on the way out, I was curious, so I stopped by the nurse's station, and I said to the head nurse, what was Hannah talking about when she said they come through the portal?" And this was back in the 70s. Now, people weren't putting any kind of real effort into taking near-death experiences really seriously, at least in the medical community. Raymond Moody hadn't written his book yet. He didn't write Life After Life until 1975, where he coined the word near-death experience. So there was no term in the vocabulary to describe really a near-death experience. So I said, "Well, I guess that must be it. You know, she is talking about it to you too." And I went home, and I got a call later that night that she had passed away. Well, I went to her funeral, and of course I led her funeral service and took my guitar and sang one of her favorite hymns. But I never could quite get over that idea. Why would she use the word portal instead of door? That intrigued me. Well, I never forgot that, and over the next 40 years of active ministry, and then since then it's been 16 years of retirement, I've had many, many opportunities to talk with people who just before their death, and in some cases who came back after they had clinically died, after they had flatlined. And I've had stories of people telling me things like, "Oh, I saw my father, I saw my mother, I saw this warm, embraceable light, and since I was an ordained minister, usually they would describe their experience in Christian terms because that was what they were used to, mm-hmm. and that's what they were expecting. They said, I saw Jesus, or I saw a saint, or something like that. If they had been Jesus, if they had been Jewish, it would have been different. They would have seen someone else. And if they were Hindu, they would have seen someone else. But in this case, I've heard so many stories about people who had this same experience. Well, I never forgot that. And 50 years later, I was visited by some people from the church where I used to serve. And the couple came and they stayed with me for the day and we talked. And he said, "Well, you know, of course, my mother died." And I said, "Yeah." And she was just another wonderful old lady, reminded me of Hannah in a lot of ways. And she said, "You know, she said something strange to me." And I said, "What was that?" She asked me who I brought with me. Well, who I brought with me? My mind just flashed back 50 years. That was the same question that Hannah said. She said, "Who have you brought with you?" And then he said, and then she told me, when I said, "I've just come alone, Mom," and she said, "Well, sometimes after you leave, they come through the portal." And she used that word portal again.
Wow.
And the use of that word, portal, and people coming through it, separated by 50 years of experience with people describing what they saw after they died, and then coupled with my own out-of-body experiences, which I didn't start having until after I had retired from Christian ministry, and my own experience of traveling out-of-body and seeing the other side. But the use of that word, portal, was just, I couldn't get it out of my head. And I said, "You know, I've got to write this book." And it came to the point where the last out-of-body experience that I experienced, I mean, the last near-death experience that I was in on was a former parishioner of mine whose name was Joe. And before I retired, he had this wonderful near-death experience, if dying can be called wonderful. He had this wonderful experience, and I called him up, and I said, "Joe, can I use your near-death experience as a way to close this book?" And because it just featured everything that near-death experiences usually have. And so Joe said yes. And so his near-death experience became the story that kind of summarized this book, and it's in the last few chapters. But that's where near-death experiences came from. Two incidents 50 years apart, but both said people coming through a portal to see me. I found that just really encouraging.
Yeah, too coincidental to be a coincidence.
yeah.
One of those things that kind of grabs your attention. And you know, from what I understand, you know, so many near-death experiences have that kind of effect on the individuals and the people that they confide in, you know, as far mm-hmm. as, you know, relating what the effect of the experience. Now, in the introduction of your book, you talk about pouring new wine into new wineskins.
Yeah.
That kind of rang a little clerical to me. So what does that mean?
Yeah, sometimes by history, my own cultural history in Christianity seeps out, and that particular phrase comes from Mark chapter 2 and verse 22, where Jesus is said to say that you can't pour new wine into old wineskins, and the reference refers to the fact that new wine, before it ferments, can get pretty yeasty and pretty active. And if you pour it into old, cracked, dry wineskins, the dry wineskins can't give with the new wine, and they tend to break. They can't contain it. Well, I began to think about the idea of near-death experiences. Now, that's a pretty yeasty thing. I mean, there's a lot of new information coming out, a lot of information, and a lot of it from the scientific community, and a lot of it from the medical community. We're reading about other dimensions now from the works of the physicists, and we're reading about other portals, for that matter, into other dimensions, and we're reading about the possibilities of our own doppelganger, so to speak, existing on, right on the other side, which was the us that we left behind, the spiritual essence of who we are that we left behind when we came through the Higgs field and our energy began to take on material force. And so that's what we're talking about there is basically science. Now, it's not a science we understand yet, but it is a science. And as a result, that stuff is starting to percolate, and it's starting to really give and open up all new ideas. And if we pour that kind of information into the old wineskins that we've been using all along, labeled, oh, it's just a supernatural, or it's just a metaphysical, or it's just a religious experience, or something like that. If we pour it into that way of thinking, I don't think that way of thinking can contain it anymore. I think it needs a whole new understanding. So I was interested, when I wrote this book, to bring the science into it, to bring the medical stuff into it. Raymond Moody, for instance, is now, after having written about and become the grandfather, so to speak, of all who study near-death experiences, he's starting to talk now about something else which he calls shared death experiences. And I've had some of those where you were around the bedside of someone who died and they had a vision of somebody. And for an instant, all those people around the hospital bed, they had the very same vision. Now, they didn't want to say it because they were afraid that people might think they were just nuts, you know, but they had it. And so I'm absolutely convinced that there is a science here that we cannot explain through the science that we now understand, because we're talking, you know, the science we now understand is designed to explain what's happening inside what I call our perception fence. We perceive the world through our five senses, and that's good. I mean, we relate to the world through sight and smell and taste and touch and hearing, and that's good. But that fence, which is designed to keep out too much information, if we just really received all this information at once, our brains probably couldn't handle it. It's a fence designed to keep certain information out and let us perceive our own perception realm in a certain way, but it also keeps things in. And what I wanted to do in this book was kind of reach up and look over the fence, see what was on the other side. And I didn't think I could do that if I could just simply talk about near-death experiences in the language that we have always associated with, which was some kind of supernatural, woo-woo, new age, mystical thing, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I felt we needed to talk about it practically, and that needs some new pliable wineskins, new pliable ways of thinking to handle this yeasty thing.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly, and the kind of the new wineskin are paradigms, the new world.
Yes,
that we kind of, you know, once we can, I don't want to say, well, quantify, once we can kind of recognize that,
yes,
you know, those experiences are, they happen often and they're so similar, you know, and mm-hmm. that, you know, and there's many times they happen to people who just aren't expecting that, you know, so it's like,
yes,
kind of out of the blue, you know, and,
right,
you know, and it's when that happens that it really shakes people's belief system.
Yeah, it can definitely change your life. I mean, talk about bringing inspiration to Earth. Nothing like a near-death experience for that. It really is, and it does change lives. If anybody who's ever heard Dr. Evan Alexander talk about his near-death experience, it was the last thing he expected. He was a doctor, a medical doctor. He wasn't dealing with this, and he didn't have any place in his mind to handle that. The word you just used, paradigm, I think is a perfect word. We need new paradigms, new ways of thinking. And I think this will do it, because if it can pitch us outside of ourself, I think it can change the world. I don't want to speak, you know, too glorious here, but I think it can change the world if we begin to look outside of ourselves and see that the reality that we think we are coming to understand is only a reality with a lowercase r, a small r. It's only one reality in a much bigger reality, the totality of reality with an uppercase r, a big r. And that can change our lives because we stop thinking about all the things that really aren't important. We start thinking about the things that are.
Yeah. And the things that are wouldn't be what we would normally think as important. And then the things that we, you know, think that are important, you know, recognizing, you know, with that wide, in the scheme of things, they're just like, you know, articles are just parts of a play, the setting of
yes.
the play, so to
yeah.
speak, you know, that we're playing yeah. right now.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you divided it into a very interesting way of organizing the book. It's based on the old marriage adage, you know, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So,
mm-hmm.
As I was going through reading it, it made sense. It was a great way of organizing. But kind of how did you decide that was a good way to arrange the book?
Well, I came upon the word when I was thinking about how to bring the new wine into new wineskins, new paradigms, new ways of thinking. I came upon the concept of the marriage of material science and spirituality. And as soon as I said that word marriage, that popped into my head, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. And I realized, oh, there it is. That's the old 19th century advice, you know, to brides. And so when I wanted to celebrate the marriage of the old, what we used to call metaphysics, and the new science, which is what we're calling quantum theory, I realized that some of these stories are very old, and that's the something old of the adage. They're stories that go way back. Plato talked about a man by the name of who had a classic near-death experience way back in the time of Plato. And before that, 6,000 years ago, the Hindu rishis were talking about this whole idea. So there were a lot of old stories, but when we bring those old stories, we have to bring them into something, a new way, new stories of thinking about death, new ways of thinking about it. And that was the old, something old and the something new. But then I wanted to get into the idea of something borrowed, because I don't think any one discipline is enough to really cover this wide field. You can't be just a medical professional or just a religious person or a spiritual person, or you can't be just a quantum physicist. You have to cross discipline, so to speak. I think one of the tragedies of our days, and I say this as someone who used to teach in college, so I was an academic myself, in order to get a doctorate degree, you have to write about something that no one else has ever written about, and so many doctorate degrees out there, you got to find something that really small and picky that nobody's ever heard of. And so we used to say if this trend keeps going, pretty soon we'll know more and more about less and less, until pretty soon we know everything about nothing. And that's kind of what it was. So I realized that if we're going to really study this, we have to borrow across discipline from one another. The scientist has got to listen to the spiritual person. The medical person has got to listen to the quantum physicist and all this kind of thing. So we have to borrow across disciplines. But then when we use the word something blue, and I thought, how many times have I heard people say, I wasn't expecting this, it just came to me out of the blue. And I thought, wow, there it is. So many times this happens to people. This was their last expectation when they got up in the morning, that they were going to have this kind of an experience. And then out of the blue, this thing hits them. So it occurred to me that that might be a pretty good way to organize the book. So I'm glad to hear your confirmation that it seems to have worked.
It does. And, you know, it just creates a wonderful flow, you know, so that, people can follow. It's kind of like, you know, you start back in time, you know, kind of like the roots, you know, of some of this thought, and then, you know, kind of bringing it into the, you know, the perceptions of the scientific discoveries. And it's, you know, one of the biggest challenges, I think, for those in the scientific community was the inability to measure, you know, those experiences using the, quote, scientific method, you know, you know, and that method kind of, you know, requires those five senses that we, you know, you talked about, and yet,
right,
you know, what the subject matter requires additional senses beyond those.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's beginning to happen. The medical community now is starting to do things that are testable according to our modern science. For instance, one of the things that happens after a person dies is a very common thing is that they seem to float up from their body. So they're looking down on their body, down on the hospital bed, on the OR, down on the doctors who are operating on them to try to bring them back. And it occurred to some medical professionals that, well, why don't we put signs up on toward the ceiling that are only visible from above if you were from a perspective on the ceiling? And we'll put signs with letters or some kind of pictures or something and see when a person dies and then comes back, see if they can tell us what those signs say. And lo and behold, they began to happen. And it led to a lot of flesh on the old bones. It really did, because I mean there were stories about people, for instance, who were dying, and they would, after they left their body, they would say, "Well, there's an old shoe out on the roof of the building or something like that," and they would go up there, and sure enough, there it was, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think people are starting to do that now. And I'm really glad to see it, because one of the things that the scientific method insists upon is that you have to be peer reviewed and you have to be able to duplicate these things. Well, it's difficult to duplicate an out of body experience, but if we can compare similar out of body experiences with this kind of scientific rigor, then maybe it'll help us to see that life is a whole lot more than we normally think it is.
Yeah, yeah. And in your book, you have one example where a patient was outside their body and saw a doctor's pen roll toward them, and, you know, was able to describe that when she came back. And the fact that she was blind and seeing. I mean, to me, that's just fascinating, recognizing that, you know, some of our earthly limitations are removed when we're in that particular state of being.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I have talked to people who were blind probably two or three times now. Personally, I've talked to them. And when they died and had an out-of-body experience, they came back and they could see. And two of those that I talked to had never been able to see. So they didn't have the faintest idea what the color blue was. They didn't have the faintest idea. They didn't have a memory of what the color red was or what a tree looked like or anything like that. And they were able to describe it, and they said it was just – one woman just brought tears to my eyes when she was saying what it was like to be able to see. I had the privilege also of talking through a translator, a signer, to one deaf person who had never been able to hear. And she communicated to me through this, her sister who could sign, she communicated to me what it was like to be able to actually hear people talk and hear vibration and to hear, she called it beautiful music when she died and came back. Just wonderful, wonderful stories. Matter of fact, the hard part about these, all having all these stories was knowing that you know, there was a word count that the publisher needed. You can't go over so many words. I had to decide which stories to leave out, and that was difficult.
I bet. Well, we're just about halfway, Jim, so I want to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we come back, I want to look, again, a little bit closer at the medical community and kind of how what they're doing with the NDE. Okay?
Yep.
Okay, great. Everyone, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder, we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to the more than 1,700 shows we have aired during the past 13 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, photography products and services, calendars, and greeting cards. There is also a link to our account at Fine Art America, where you can purchase items such as mugs, prints, pillows, and more. Our show is available as a free podcast on multiple platforms, such as iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, and Audible, with icons to each platform on our homepage. We are also available on social media platforms such as Facebook, X, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Threads. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again today. My special guest is Jim Willis, and we are talking about his new book, Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is www.jimwillis.net. And this is definitely one of those books that you'll want to pick up if you are at all interested in near-death experiences. Okay, with that, we're back, Jim. Hello, Jim. Do I have you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm still here.
I was thinking maybe you were just having another one of your OBEs.
No. I was carried away.
Okay, so I want to. You know, as I was going through and reading the book, you know, there were, you have so much information in each of those categories that you broke down in the book that I just kind of highlighted a couple just to give the readers an idea of what they can expect when reading your book. Now, we kind of covered that something old, you know, with the fact that, I mean, that it goes back centuries. You know, the idea of near-death experiences. Now, in the something new, you've kind of alluded to that the medical community kind of taking note now and you know, making, you know, kind of trying to reckon with that experience as being valid. And one of the things that I found interesting is in that section on field of medicine, you indicated that the community is kind of creating its own language to be able to deal with this experience, and they have used the term transphysical. And I had never heard of transphysical. So, you know, what can you tell us about, you know, just the medical field, and maybe, you know, is this their way of trying to rebrand, you know, in a way, and then UFOs are now UAP, you know. So
yeah, I know. There's another deep dark secret about the academic community or the established communities, and that's that once a field is recognized as being a field unto itself, and once it has years to grow and specialists to come along, it's very difficult for them to admit that anybody else can teach them anything. And one of the things they have to do is come up with their own language that describes old, old concepts. And that's, you know, for instance, in the New Testament book of 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul talks about a very definite near-death experience that he had. When he was taken up, he said, to the third heaven, and he heard things that he was not even able to tell us about. I think what he was saying was that language was insufficient. Well, this is an old religious story that goes back, you know, some 2,000 years now. And when you come into talking about doctors and scientists nowadays in the year 2024, you know, they don't like to necessarily say that the experience of a man who lived 2,000 years ago is going to have much to say to them. So they like to develop their own scientific way of saying it, make it very academic and all that kind of thing. And I discovered that when I was talking to people who, especially who worked in emergency rooms and hospitals, who are more used to seeing these kinds of things happen, when I talked to the doctors, there was a hesitancy, probably because they were afraid what their colleagues were going to think if they got into all this mystical stuff and everything else. But when I talked to the nurses, that was a different story. It was the nurses, both women and men, who would tell me stories about being with somebody and seeing something depart the body at the moment of death. They had no problems with that. I remember one incident, for instance, where I was just about ready to retire. I had about 6 to 8 months left to go. But I was up here in South Carolina. My church was down in Florida, but I was up here on vacation in South Carolina. I was starting to build my house that I was going to live in when I retired. And I got a call that a very good friend of mine from the church who was active in our music program was in the hospital, and he wasn't expected to make it. And could I possibly come down, even though it was the middle of my vacation? They were acting like somehow this would be a terrible inconvenience. I said, no, of course not. So I put stuff away, got in the car, and drove 6 hours and went right straight to the hospital. And I was, as a result, I was able to be there with him and his wife. And we were there actually at his hospital room and actually holding him and talking to him and praying with him when he breathed his last breath. And I was amazed at what happened next. Now, this was a veterans hospital. He was in the armed forces. And so he was in the veterans hospital, and you would think that they would tend to be rather matter of fact. But a nurse came in, and she could tell right away that he had passed. And she looked at me, and she said, can you stick around for about 10 or 15 minutes? I said, of course I can. And sure enough, she gathered together all the medical staff on that floor, doctors and nurses both, and she asked me if I might lead them in a kind of prayer time or a short memorial service right there while they were all together. And so we were all standing around in a circle holding hands, and I asked people to say various things, and I was amazed by the feeling of not heaviness, oh, we've lost a patient, but lightness, oh, he's gone on. And I had never seen this in a hospital before, and I was very encouraged. I really was. So I think some of these words, like what was the word that you just mentioned? Was it transphysical?
Transphysical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, transphysical. You know, they may use language to try to describe it. The idea of you know, anything that tends to tell me that they are acknowledging the fact that there is something beyond the physical. To me, that's a good thing. And so I like this kind of language, although I understand the culture from which it comes, so we have to take it with a grain of salt at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and it's, you know, I can understand, you know, the idea of some peer pressure that some may feel, you know, when, you know, delving into topics that are
aren't strictly, you know, taught in medical school kind of topics.
Yeah.
But, you know, if creating new verbiage to describe what is happening helps, then I'm awful. You know, that's fine.
Yeah,
call it what you want.
As long as we don't, as long as they don't make the next step and, you know, criticize people for using the old verbiage to describe something new. Like, for instance, I've heard people talk about UAPs right now, and when somebody says UFO, he says, oh, we don't call them that anymore, you know, patronizing them. And, oh, that's terrible. But on the other hand, if it helps, great. But like everything else involved with us humans, it's very easy for us to go too far, to become too ego-driven and too much aware of our own presence and our own limits. And I think that's a shame. I am finding something really strange now, because when I retired and moved up here to the woods of South Carolina, my purpose was that I wanted to really experience this spirituality. I said experience God. I have no problem with the word God, although the word God has so much baggage nowadays that I don't like to use it too much, because when I say God, somebody may think that what I mean by God is the same thing they mean by God, and it's probably two different things. So I like to use the word source. But I've discovered something kind of strange happening ever since I've been, you know, writing some books and retiring from it. I don't have to prove anything anymore, and I don't have to protect my reputation anymore. And so I'm talking openly about things like dowsing for earth energy and having out-of-body experiences. And whereas in the past there were those of my circle, my colleagues, who would look down on me for talking like this, now they're looking at my life work and they're looking at what I've written, and they realize that, well, maybe he is saying something. Maybe we need to listen to it. And they're taking it seriously. I'm very encouraged by that. I really am.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's I've had many a guest who comes from a medical kind of training who, upon experiencing one, you know, unusual, you know, or
yes.
Right. Physical kinds of experiences, that's, you know, what kind of shakes them. As a matter of fact, I really clearly remember, I've been doing my show for 13 years. I think it was about the first 3 years it was a gentleman. And in your book, you talk about the Monroe Institute, you know,
yes.
And some of the work that they're doing. And this gentleman was an anesthesiologist who lost his son. It was during, you know, his son being put under through anesthesia. So, I mean, it was like, you know, really hit home with him. And it was after he attended the Monroe Institute and kind of was able to tap into his son's passing and the importance that it had in his life, you know, in continuing his life in a very constructive way, and you know, not to allow that passing to hinder his growth, but instead kind of, you know, catapulted him, you know, toward, you know, a wider understanding. You know, and so it seems like whenever, you know, an individual, and for, you know, for what I was getting to is like you with your theology background, you know, and your particular experiences and the way that you phrase them and the fact that you're not, that you're able to broaden your perspective to include the theology and to include the experience, you know, that it gives others the permission to be able to open up to that.
You know, it's funny, you talk about the Monroe Institute. The man who founded the Monroe Institute, Robert Monroe, basically, when he had his first out-of-body experience, he was a skeptic himself. And it turned his life around. when I started having out-of-body experiences, which I think are very closely connected to near-death experience. The only good thing is you don't have to die first like you do in a near-death experience. But when he started, when I started having my out-of-body experiences and experiencing these landscapes that I had never seen before or experienced before, I wanted to study it seriously. And so I went up to the Monroe Institute, and I spent a week up there with a small group and Bill Buhlman, who I think is probably the foremost teacher in the world today, perhaps, of out-of-body experiences. And when I was up there seeing these people from all walks of life, we had a couple who had come all the way from Australia, and he was in business there in Australia. We had I was the only minister, but we had people who were just all over the map in terms of their culture or background and what they knew and everything else. And they all came together around this topic, and it was just a wonderful feeling, a wonderful experience for a week up there, as we explored the idea of techniques and everything else involved in out-of-body experiences. So I think this is something that can really go cross-cultural, and I'm kind of upset a little bit that some of the biggest negativity comes from the churches. There are those, for instance, I had a conversation with one man once who was a minister. He was younger than me and everything else. And he said, well, you talk about all these other dimensions and beings who come through portals and all this kind of stuff. He says, I'm a Christian. I don't believe in that kind of stuff. And I said, at Christmas time, do you stand with your congregation and sing the song, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Glory to the Newborn King? He said, of course I do. And I said, well, what are you singing about? And you could see when it connected in his mind, his jaw just dropped, because what he was singing about was angels, extra-dimensional entities, coming out and producing a vibratory experience, which we translate as music, vibration, and they were bringing a message from one dimension into another dimension. It was right there in his own religion, and he never put it together. And I think it changed him. I really do. At least I hope it did.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think part of that reluctance is that, you know, it seemed to me that many of the religious structures around, not just Christianity, but, you know, basically all religious, maybe except for Buddhism, the idea is that, you know, there is, it's like my way or the highway, you know, this is the way of viewing it, instead of recognizing that, you know, there are many pathways to the top of the mountain.
Whenever I'm anywhere near a church now, I still have the Reverend in front of my name. I don't use it, but it's still there legally. And I haven't been inside a church now for 16 years, I guess. But whenever I used to go to a church and I used to hear that this is the way, we have the way, our theology is the correct. Whenever I hear that, I just want to just walk right away, because it's simply not the case. Religions, like other academic disciplines, I've been involved with archaeologists who think this way, and with physicians who think this way, and with physics people who think this way. They always think, well, once we've, you know, gathered our little group together, we're going to build a fence around it, and this is now the way to experience it. And once you start building fences instead of, once you start building walls instead of bridges, you're in trouble. And I think that's one of the troubles. I was listening to a preacher recently. I won't give any names or anything else, but it was a church in the next state over from me. And he gave a forceful sermon, and he was basically talking about loving your neighbor as yourself, and how he believed that some people in his church were not doing that. But just for the fun of it, I flipped off the sound. and watched him, and his body language was all about anger. And he was shaking his fist and walking around, and his face was angry. And here he was talking about love. And I thought, what a contrast. We have to get away from that somehow. It's very, very difficult to do. But people are afraid to do that. I remember when back in 1957, when Hugh Everett gave us the mini worlds concept of quantum physics, the idea that there are all these bubble universes that are constantly forming whenever a measurement is made and all this kind of thing, and that we can flip a coin and it comes up heads, and we think there, that was it once and for all, without even realizing that in another dimension so close to us that we can't perceive it with our senses, but it's right there, there was another us who flipped the same coin, but it came up tails. And they thought that was the only thing that was true. They could only experience one reality at a time. And when Hugh Everett tried to talk about this back in 1957, it wasn't just that he was rejected. His ideas were rejected. He was slandered. He was ridiculed. He was kicked out of the physics community. One of the most brilliant physicists who ever lived. And he couldn't get a job. He couldn't get any money. No one wanted to hire him. And he had to go work for the government. And he died thinking he was a total failure. And now his ideas are accepted by physicists around the world. But we have this horrible tendency, I think, as humans, when somebody says something we don't agree with, rather than going after their ideas, we go after their character. And that, I think, is a real shame. It's a real mistake.
Yeah. The very idea that the Earth isn't flat. I mean,
yeah.
What do you
yeah.
mean?
Perfect. Perfect.
Well, we're kind of getting down toward the end of the show. I could talk for a long time, but there was one other area that I wanted to mention. And, you know, you talked about NDEs and we talked about OBEs, out-of-body experiences, but also in your chapter on NDEs in the military, you also broached the idea of remote viewing. So can you talk just a little bit about, that and maybe how it is consistent with maybe OBE and NDE? I mean, the interrelation between those particular types of experiences.
Yeah. This was a fascinating thing to me, that some of the records that the military used to keep are now open. The statute of limitations has run out, and now we're starting to hear. And as a result, when I was up at the Monroe Institute, for instance, I would hear people such as Skip Atwater, who was the head of the remote viewing top secret movement, and Joseph McGonigal, who was remote viewer number one. And Dean Radin from out at the Noetic Institute, Dean and I have passed some things back and forth, some emails back and forth when I needed his help. And they were all involved in this, but they couldn't say anything because it was top secret. But basically what they were doing was training people to try to and they were doing it sometimes at the Monroe Institute using Bob Monroe's techniques, training people to become long-distance spies, so to speak. In out-of-body experiences, there's two kinds of terms, and each one has a technical term attached to it. Some people talk about astral travel, and some people talk about etheric travel, and there is a subtle difference between them. Technically, travel, out-of-body travel within our own physical plane and time, like the remote viewers were doing, while out of body, technically that's called etheric travel. Well, whereas astral travel includes experiencing different times and different planes of existence, some of which appear to be extremely foreign to anything experienced on Earth. Robert Monroe was really good about explaining the differentiation, and he often said that etheric travel took place in what he called local one, or he sometimes called it the here now. And in this type of out-of-body experience, travelers relate to certain people and places that actually exist right now. And that's why volunteers from the military were trained, sent to the Monroe Institute to study remote viewing. The Army basically wanted to know if it was possible to spy on enemies in real time from the secure comfort of our own living room. And it's funny, I've had both of those experiences, and they are quite unique. In etheric traveling, I've had the opportunity to travel to different places that are right here on Earth, but I knew where I was. In one case, for instance, I went to Martha's Vineyard, and it was, you know, I recognized it because I had been to Martha's Vineyard. But in another sense, I've had out-of-body experiences involving, mythical beasts and strange landscapes which I'll never understand. And I think that's what happens in near-death experiences. I talk about this some in the book, about how people have these experiences and they come back and they try to explain what they saw on the other side. And they can't really do it because our language was invented to describe the reality within our own perception fence. And once you get outside, you're looking at things and seeing things and experiencing things that are totally different than anything you've ever had through your five senses. That's why I don't think you can come back and say, you know, people say, well, what do you see when you die? And I say, well, I can only say what I see. I can't tell you what you see. A person can come back and they can't say, this is what it is. I think all they can do is say, this is what it seemed like to me. Because their memory is filtered through their own experience. And anybody who's ever had a vivid dream that seemed so real and so vivid that you knew you were there in it somehow, and then you came back and you tried to explain it and it sounded kind of silly, because language, human language just simply cannot express what you are experiencing, because it's experiencing outside of the realm in which language was invented. That's why when people get really desperate sometimes when they want to talk to me about this, they'll say things like, well, when a person dies and they hear this message or they hear this person, how come they're always talking in English? I'm saying, well, they're not. But the only way the person can describe communication is English, because that's the language of the native speaker. They're not speaking in any language that we know of. They're speaking in a total different concept, away from time. They're not receiving ideas one word at a time. They're receiving these blocks of teaching that come, and all of a sudden they somehow just understand. And they say, well, how can you possibly understand? How can you learn all that so quickly? Well, I didn't learn it. I just knew it.
Exactly. Well, you know, and one of the things also in the book, there was at one point you were talking about our first impression of another reality depends on what we expect to find. And, you know, I often thought that, you know, that was kind of like the best way to transition. You know, you go to what you expect, you know, and that is kind of like, you know, that if you were, you know, you transitioned into something that was completely foreign, and, you know, it would be, I think, it would be a rough
be a little scary. I think it's a blessing, you know, not a curse, that we carry the familiar with us. And then when we get there, we have something familiar to kind of latch onto. Now, it will gradually fade. And I hate to use the word gradually, because that's a time word, and I don't think time exists over there. But I think gradually we'll slough it off as we become more accustomed to it. But I think it's a real blessing that we have that comfort of seeing something familiar on the other side.
Exactly. Well, Jim, this has really been a lot of fun, and I really, like I said, I enjoyed your book. You know, and it really is jam-packed of information, and it's so well referenced, so that if someone wants to explore further, you know, some of the topics that you cover, you really give a good reference for people to refer to if they want to explore further. So I want to thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you for having me on. And you're doing important work, speaking to a community of people who are being held together by these kind of like-minded ideas. And keep it up, because it's great work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Jim Willis. We've been talking about his new book, Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. And again, you can find out more about his book and his other books as well by visiting his website, which is www.jimwillis.net. That's JimWillis.net. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To become a show follower, visit www.blogtalkradio.com/BikeRadioMe and click on the follow link. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at BikeRadioMe. Be sure to visit our website at www.BikeRadio.me. That's BikeRadio.me. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.